it's 9:45. Time for SF on Sea, a kaleidoscope special report by Peter Nichols on the 1984 European Science Fiction Convention held last week in Brighton.
The first convention I went to, the most intellectual game they had was people taking off their socks and throwing them against the wall, and the guy whose socks clung there longest won.
The science fiction audience and creators are interactive in a way that I don't know in any other field. I've always regarded the science fiction reader, at least the fan, as the larval stage of the science fiction writer. You know, we're all the same blood, and I think that's why writers come to conventions. One of the many reasons, apart from getting drunk.
It's a grand social and intellectual treat. Some people are restrained and go to bed early, but generally it gets liveliest about 3 o'clock in the morning when you do charades based on science fiction titles. And it can be a bit of a strain doing with the Benfin Boomer Boys in little old New Alabama at 3 o'clock in the morning. Not to mention, if all men were brothers, would you let one marry your sister?
Just went along to an Easter con, home that I did, and knew that I belonged. I'm a fan, an SF fan. Just was me talking and a drinking and a talking.
Over Easter weekend, in a huge rambling hotel in Brighton, almost 2,000 people gathered to attend SeaCon 84, the 35th annual British Easter Science Fiction Convention. Over 40 of them were writers, maybe 100 were publishers and agents, and the rest, ranging from taxi drivers to university professors, were science fiction fans. 1984 is a special year in science fiction circles, or SF circles, as the fans would say. It's the year when we've got the chance to see whether George Orwell had it right, and it's also the year when the European Science Fiction Convention was combined with the British Easter Convention for the first time. So we had guests of honour, not only from the UK and the USA, which is usual, but also from France, Germany and Czechoslovakia. And people attended from Japan and Russia and Australia, and from almost every European country, even including Bulgaria. SF conventions were not always on this scale. Kenneth Bulmer, author of over 100 books, many under pseudonyms, has been coming to conventions since the early days.
My first convention was in 1941, where John Bain and Harris, at that time he was changing over to being John Wyndham. And then after the war, we started up again, and the London Circle, being the largest group in the country, ran most of the conventions, which originally were one-day, two-day affairs, at which we all sat on hard wooden chairs in a hall, very serious and constructive about science fiction. And gradually it developed. Other people came in, we expanded, and the breakthrough came when we went away. The first one was to Manchester, where we had to stay in a hotel overnight. And that, of course, made the huge difference, because then you could run up and down the corridor shrieking and fire zap guns at each other and generally have a good time without having to go home. We were the oppressed minority. People laughed and sneered at science fiction because going to the moon, ha 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 ha, artificial hearts, ha ha ha, etc., etc. Prophecy in those terms was laughed and sneered at. Well, now, the modern fan is a science fiction person from the day he grows up, really. He's born into what, to us, was a future world.
The world of the future was visibly on display at SeaCon, and some fans spent the entire weekend incarcerated in a large room, locked in computer combats of various kinds. But there was also a rock concert with the old SF favourites Hawkwind as the star attraction. A nearly continuous programme of films, A vast program of serious discussions with as many as 1,000 people packed into a hall to listen to it. An art show and a book room the size of a modest cathedral packed with buyers. It was notable how many people were buying nothing but comics. At the same time, there's a market for serious writers like Susie McKee Charnas, best known for her fantasy novel, The Vampire Tapestry. What does she make of this seeming paradox?
I think it's a polarization, because although there is a generation that is maturing, that's already pretty old, 30s and 40s, that reads real books, the younger people coming up are giving disturbing signs of not reading much of anything and of being totally captives of the media. Well, they're interested in playing games and in acting things out and in a lot of vicarious living going on, which is not really literature in the same sense that reading a book is, because it's communal. So that we may be writing for the last big generation of readers that there is for some time. And that's kind of a creepy feeling.
The polarization Susie speaks of was obvious. SF fandom is not homogenous. Some fans spend hours talking about the space program, while others are dressed up in bearskins and carrying swords. The mainstream of SF fans tend to be rather contemptuous of such subgroups as Star Wars fans and Star Trek fans. The latter group are always known as the Trekkies.
Well, I'm an SF fan, I'm proud of what I am. I say what I think, but Star Trek thinks, yes, I'm an SF fan. With the kings in the con hall, I'll be bolting with them all. With a hell of a shout, it's Star Trekkie out.
Spoke to a female Trekkie who told me that Trekkie conventions have a higher intellectual standard than ordinary science fiction conventions. I asked why this was. She paused and then told me she thought it must be because so many lawyers attended them. Such respectability. Frederick Pohl is one of the legendary names of science fiction. His career began in 1940. When he was given the editorship of a pulp magazine called Astonishing Stories at the age of 19, and he's never looked back since. How did science fiction get respectability?
From 1954 on, it has become possible for a science fiction writer to have a permanence to what he writes. Everything that was written in those early magazines from 1926 to 1954 was one-time disposable story. You'd write it, you'd see it published, people would read it, and it was gone because the magazines went off the stands. And no one ever thought that they had any duration to them. Since then, it's been possible not only to have a story appear in a magazine, but to have it appear in a book and have that book remain on sale for a long time, which has greatly benefited the prosperity of science fiction writers. And it has also meant that there's more scholarship and critical attention to what's written in science fiction, which some say has elevated the standards. I have personal doubts about that, but I think that there may be some truth to it.
Like Frederick Pohl, Marion Zimmer Bradley is a writer who's made the transition from social outcast to elder statesman, though it is noticeable that the British publishers of her recent best-selling historical romance, The Mists of Avalon, dropped her middle name from the cover. It was apparently felt that the exotic middle name Zimmer might have undesirable science fiction connotations. She, too, has seen science fiction grow up.
I think it's rather like what happened to Raymond Chandler. In his own day, he was regarded as simply a hack writer of pulp fiction, detective stories ghettoized. Later, the critics discovered that Chandler was a serious artist who simply happened to apply his intelligence and his thought and his ideas to the field of the detective story. And I feel that there are certainly enough major talents working in science fiction. It used to be escape reading for young men who didn't wish to think about the world of competition. Tarzan is your ultimate case in point, or John Carter of Mars. It was the world of technology. It also was what one fan called almost obscenely sexless. There were no women in the stories, or at most the mad scientist's daughter to stand around screaming. Now it recognizes that humanity is more than just the men in it. It used to be very much a fiction for boys. Now it is a fiction not only for adult men and women, but for young women as well.
A contestant in the fancy dress masquerade sings a rather marshmallowy song adapted from Tolkien's Silmarillion. There was a lot of this sort of thing around, and some cynics see the recent emphasis on dragons and quests and magical fantasy, which to some extent has been replacing science fiction proper in recent years, as being the fault of the many women writers who have been entering the field. 15 years ago, only 10% of science fiction fans were women. Now it's maybe 30%. A healthy sign, you might think. But even Susie Charnas recognizes that the history of SF has led to something of a male-female split.
Actually, I think if you pinned us all down, we would say, well, there's a propensity for women to write from intuition and from soft sciences because that's our training and our background. And for men to write technical stuff because that's their training and their background. And if the culture changed the way you were brought up and offered you more alternatives in the opposite field and area, you'd probably write much more technically as a woman and much more intuitively as a man. And in fact, there's a great deal of crossover going on now. But I think because the field was dominated for a long time by male writers writing for boys, it was very technical and very heavily involved in men's concerns as the culture defines them. And now that women have come in, it's beginning to shift a bit.
The first prize for original design, the prize goes to number 23, Alison Cook as Sweet Orb Mace.
My alias is Sweet Orb Mace from Michael Moorcock's Dancers at the End of Time trilogy. It's in the best possible taste. It's in purple and silver lamé, has 41 meters of silver sequins, a gross of diamante, about 150 flashing LEDs, light-emitting diodes, lights, and fiber optics in the staff. My first convention was CECON 79, which was the World Convention, which was in Brighton here. And I went in for the fancy dress then because I'd never been to a con before and I was afraid I was going to get stuck in my room all the time. I, in fact, teach needlework and actually ordinary dressmaking. I resent every stitch. But this isn't dressmaking, this is engineering.
The fancy dress contest is over, and the hotel corridors are seething. I just saw a Japanese samurai walk by, followed by a glazed-looking man with a Pekingese dog under his arm and three grossly fat Americans. The bar is full of writers drinking real ale at knockdown prices. The time is ripe to consider the serious function of science fiction. Who more appropriate than Harry Harrison, one of whose classic tales of lunatic adventure on the starways was dramatized on Radio 4 only last week, to tell us about whether or not SF is pure entertainment, or whether perhaps it might sometimes conceal dangerously subversive messages? Why did he write Bill the Galactic Hero?
The whole thing is just kick up the kilt to military types, and that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I hope I did. And I saw the science fiction format as being ideal for what I wanted to do at that time, which seems to have worked out. Science fiction has to do with anything you want to deal with. It's a very open-ended field, you know, and the boundaries of which I try to push out all the time. I personally have very firm political opinions, and my early days, I knew I could sell adventure novels. I always put below the adventure a firm political statement of some kind, or in the case of Death World 2, a firm philosophical statement. The entire book, behind all the rushing around and guns going off, is the difference between ethics and ethos. And you can only do that in science fiction. There's a very important difference which we always obscure. That entire book is written around that difference. You can do this in science fiction. The action readers ignore it, and people who are alive and warm and have heartbeats may notice it.
The question of whether or not SF tends to have a concealed political content is altogether more delicate when put to a writer from Eastern Europe. Josef Nesvadba is a psychoanalyst and a film screenwriter. One of his six films, Tomorrow I Scalded Myself with Tea, was recently shown on BBC Two. He's also a distinguished social satirist who chooses very often to work in the science fiction mode. He was the Czechoslovakian guest of honor at CECON.
People tend here to judge everything what comes over from Eastern Europe as a political thing. You know, I think this is why many authors from there avoid it, if they just don't want to jump the dissident bandwagon. Because when you judge everything what is coming out of Eastern Europe only by this criteria, you are practically not going to understand the stuff at all. You know, it is much more complicated. I could agree with you that it may be critical, that there is an establishment criticism in it, but if you turn the problem, there is an establishment criticism inherent practically in or more or less every big science fiction or every big work of art, you know, even in the West and even in the most liberal countries.
Whether or not SF has an occasionally subversive function in the communist bloc, where it is the best-selling form of literature, is questionable, it seems. In the West, many critics have complained that most SF could be described as capitalist enterprise stories set out on the stars. The British SF writer Ian Watson, whose new and very readable novel, The Book of the River, came out from Galanx only yesterday, tends to agree that much SF is right-wing propaganda.
Well, a hell of a lot of it is right-wing propaganda, but the hell of a lot of it that you're talking about is the American segment of science fiction, which dominates commercially the world science fiction market. There is a kind of Mount Parnassus in science fiction, as we view it from this country or from Europe, whereby the glittering gold-clad upper slopes are occupied by America. The lower slopes are denizened by the British simply by virtue of the fact that we speak English so that they can understand our books. And in outer darkness in the Stygian marshes beneath lurk the Europeans, Japanese, Bulgarians, Russians and so forth. Actually, the bulk of science fiction is written by foreigners, but you would never believe it. No matter what bookshop you went into in China, Rio de Janeiro, Britain or wherever. So yeah, right-wing propaganda, but this is reflecting the commercial economic dominance of the science fiction market by American science fiction.
American SF these days is symbolized above all by the film Star Wars, and that cropped up all over the place. Even in Bob Shaw's Serious Scientific Talk Without Jokes, one of the most popular events at every annual Easter convention.
The Death Star in Star Wars was designed and run largely by computers, but following a long-established tradition in space opera, it had one weak spot in its defenses. Now this weak spot always takes the form of a little round hole, possibly the overflow from the captain's lavatory. Which is always just big enough to accommodate a torpedo. And on the Death Star, this hole was cleverly positioned at the end of a sort of metallic canyon about 100 miles long. Now, the canyon was heavily defended by all kinds of things, multi-barreled ray guns all along its length. And nobody had seemed to have thought of the more cost-effective idea of putting a metal grill over the little hole. Well, we all remember what this meritorious and masterly plan of attack was. It was to enter the 100-mile canyon, which led to nowhere except the little round hole, at the wrong end. But they did manage it in the end after losing about 2,300 fighters or something. They did shoot the torpedo into the little hole, and I love to think of that torpedo sort of bouncing and rattling along that drain pipe, you know, into the barrels of the Death Star. And round all the S bends and everything, and finally emerging from the captain's laboratory at 1,000 miles an hour. I only hope the poor guy wasn't sitting on it at the time.
That attack was humorous, but the speaker, Bob Shaw, is one of our most distinguished SF writers. So too is this year's British guest of honor at SeaCon, Christopher Priest, who's also been brooding on the Star Wars phenomenon.
I think that films like Star Wars have actually sounded the death knell, because in many ways, my belief is that science fiction is an essentially decadent form, which wears out, and Star Wars is like the logical result of that, where it's extremely well done, and it's very highly crafted, but they're completely and utterly retrospective. They're drawing from the past with all the images from the generality of the pulp magazines and all the books and Dune and all the great bestsellers. And in a sense, those were sort of summing up. And at that point, we should have all given up. And in fact, I don't think any serious work has appeared in the science fiction field as such since then. I mean, books have appeared around it and outside it. But science fiction seems now to be confirming the inevitable. I'm quoting Joanna Russ here, who wrote an article about 10 or 15 years ago called The Wearing Out of Genre Materials. And the point she made in that is that you only have a certain amount of stock ideas or situations in genre writing. And she cites the Western, where you start off with the first Western films, then you start getting the great classic Western films, then you end up with Blazing Saddles or the joke Western films. And in science fiction, you have the example of, say, robots, where you have the three stages, the discovery of robots, and then you get the second stage where the thing is actually explored in great depth, and you get the three laws of robotics, and you get all the possibilities of the use of robots. And then you get the third stage where they become props, and you have paranoid androids, and you have coal-fired robots, and robots that break down and legs fall off and serve the tea and open the door. And by that point, robots, as in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, are just another stock in trade, and there's actually no metaphorical life left in them.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has a cult following among SF fans, and thus our very own Radio 4 has entered fanish history. Hitchhiker fandom this year was represented by the Vogon Poetry Reading Contest. You will remember that Vogon poetry is, by definition, the most boring poetry in the universe.
Vogon poetry. Vogon. Vogon, Vogon. Vogon, Vogon, Vogon! Vogon! Vogon, Vogon, Vogon. Vogon, Vogon, Vogon! Vogon.
Vogon! Vogon! Vogon!
Vogon!
An SF convention is really an extraordinary sociological phenomenon. All that vast scale administration, as well as the manual labor, is performed for love, not money, by dedicated SF fans. Some of them save up even all year, maybe even skip their summer holidays to attend these conventions, which are far from profit-making events. Nevertheless, after paying registration, hotel, food and drink bills, it must average a cost of well over £100 a head to attend it. What is this worldwide eccentric family of SF fandom, which even has its own private language? It was all explained by Ian Sorensen, a young Scots fan, who acted as one of the head gophers who worked 10 hours a day or more trying to create order out of chaos. And this year he was also the author of a musical all about fandom.
Ba 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 fan. Ba 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 I'm a fan.
Fandom is completely disorganized, but it operates in peer group way. You enter fandom as a neo newcomer, and you either just go to conventions or you might produce a fanzine, and you keep plugging away, plugging away, and eventually your name gets known. And once your name gets known, other people refer to you as a big name fan. So that's the nearest we get to social strata. You're either a neo, a fan, or a big name fan.
Big name fan, everybody
gonna try for something new.
You have to explain the fannish terms even to fans. They can be quite esoteric. Words like gaffiate, which is an acronym from gaffia, get away from it all. When you quit fandom, you gaffiate. It's simple things like what a fanzine is. A fanzine is any publication made up by a fan. If it's serious, it's called Sercon, which is serious and constructive fanzine. Or you can just do a silly zine, a fun zine, or a fun fanzine. If you do things, if you participate in running conventions, if you produce a fanzine, then you get ego boo. There's another word for you. Ego boosting.
Drink in a jar, standing at the bar, 27 pints is around par for a plan.
There are 2,000 people here this weekend. I will recognize probably half of them because I see them once or twice a year at various conventions up and down the country or abroad. So if I wanted to go to Sweden for a holiday, I would know somebody in Sweden that I met at a convention and could probably stay with them. We get the same thing over here. You get an American turning up on your doorstep saying, "Hi, I read your fanzine. Could I stay the night?" It's a worldwide social organization.
Ba 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 ba.
It isn't only the fans who think of science fiction as being one massive worldwide family group. The writers are very conscious of it too, especially Brian Aldiss, one of our senior British authors, who's attended events just like these in Tokyo, Moscow, Trieste and Rio de Janeiro. Is SF a kind of international password?
Well, it travels easily across barriers. The subject matter doesn't have the built-in frontiers of your Hampstead bedsitter novel, or the more typical English novel at the moment, which would be about a middle-aged lady who, having given over all her life to a series of male chauvinist pigs and five children, discovers suddenly that she is emancipated and is about to write her first novel. The subject matter of science fiction is not about these kinds of things. It's about some threat to the world in general on the whole. That is to say, if you have your lawn dying off in your own house, that is a private English novel. But if all the lawns die off all over the world, then that's science fiction.
It's getting late, and some of us have had almost no sleep for 4 days. A glistening future beckons, and this year the lucky ones have avoided their pasts catching up with them. SeaCon 84 is remarkably scandal-free, though there were some mild amours conducted in dark corners, and a hotel manager, looking very harassed, told everybody to go to bed at 5 o'clock in the morning. I've been attending these events, first as a fan and then as a science fiction encyclopedist, for 12 years now, and this is my 40th convention. I haven't gaffiated yet. We've reached the happy stage at convention's end where old enemies are getting maudlin and pressing drinks on one another. The sprawling science fiction family has renewed its bonds for another year. As 2,000 exhausted people begin to think about staggering futuristically home to the round Earth's imagined corners, even the sometimes vinegary Ian Watson is smiling.
I'm a devotee of the things in many respects. I've been to lots of them in Britain and a number on the continent. I even wrote a story about them called the World Science Fiction Convention of 2080, in which I imagine that after the collapse of civilization, the one thing that continues onwards is science fiction conventions. Even though you have to evade Muslim pirates as you cross the Atlantic, and even though wolf packs dog your heels as you hike down from furthest Quebec to the conventions, and they stand around at this convention and celebrate the fact that at last they can enjoy their science fiction, because once the science has been removed by a total technological collapse of the world, the old mythic impetus can sweep back again, and once more we can enjoy the notion of wandering the sands of Mars and sailing across the oceans of Venus, because it is impossible. And one thing distinguishes science fiction writers, I think, from writers in most other genres, such as crime or romance, that when we hold conventions, that all of our readers are there, as well as the writers, and that we mix together. It is a brotherhood and sisterhood, and you know, I think that the most right-wing reactionary American science fiction writers would link arms with left-wing deviants like me on the common ground of science fiction, and it is this kind of solidarity that brings about an event like this, and which is part of the lifeblood of science fiction, and the reason why I love it.
I'm science fiction crazy and mad about the stars. I built myself a telescope to look at life on Mars. I always scan for UFOs, morning, night and noon. I'm not content with Earthling's ways. I'm reaching for the...
Music from the group Alien Dream, ending Kaleidoscope's report from the 1984 European Science Fiction Convention in Brighton. The programme was written and presented by Peter Nichols and produced by Richard Dunn.